Hi, this is John Stone from 10,000 Blades, and you're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM, streaming live at newhavenindependent.org. All the best of food and drink, a glass of wine, a smile, a wink. Don't have a cow, don't make a stink, it's Lucy in the kitchen sink.
Hey, New Haveners, and welcome back to another episode of Kitchen Sink. I'm your host, Lucy Gelman, and I am very excited to be in the studio today with Catherine McCormick. You may know that name because maybe you've seen her around town with a little cart and a couple of wheels. It has wheels, right, Catherine? Mm-hmm. Couple of wheels and some much-needed caffeine. So I'm welcoming you to the studio because I want to know more about this coffee business, but also the spirit of female entrepreneurship that you're bringing to New Haven. And you're quite young as well. So we'll get into all of those things. But first of all, welcome.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
So first tell us about this new venture and then we'll backpedal a little bit. No pun intended.
Sure. So this is an idea that I came up with because I walk a lot in Worcester Square. I live on Hughes Place, so right in the middle of Worcester Square, right next to the park. And I walk a lot and I see a lot of, let's say, underutilized properties, empty parking lots, buildings that used to have businesses in their storefronts but now are either shuttered or are used as sort of temporary storage. And as an urbanist and sort of an aspiring real estate developer and land use lawyer, this is something that irritates me because I see these prime pieces of real estate that are walkable and accessible because I've walked past them and could access them if they had something inside of them, and there's nothing inside, so I see waste and it irritates me. And I have this knack for coming up with ideas for quick fix solutions, or if I see something that seems wasteful, my imagination works in a way that will spring to try to fill voids. And so the idea of the coffee shop came about because two sources. I walk around the neighborhood, see all these underutilized spaces, and sadly, Worcester Square is sorely in need of a coffee shop. Fuel Coffee closed in May, and even when it was open this past, I guess, year or so, yeah, it was in its downsized location on Worcester Street as opposed to its larger location on Chapel Street. Which closed several years ago, I think.
Yeah, in like, it closed right after I moved here. So that was like 2013, 2014.
Oh, yeah. So it's been a while. And so I knew the former Fuel. And when they relocated to Worcester Street, it just didn't have the same atmosphere as a real coffee shop. Yeah. It was very small. There was no seating. And I think more than just the caffeine rush or the need to sell coffee and pastries, what I really want to see in Worcester Square is a place for community gathering. So seating and ample seating space and communal tables, all of that is very important to me.
And one of the things as I was getting to know a little bit about this coffee cart is that it parks in it's Russo Park, right?
Correct.
And Russo Park, maybe park is kind of a misnomer because it's a little more like a parking lot. You know, it's a park in I guess the sense of the word, but it's more concrete than it is, you know, grass and daffodils and, yes, and anything like that. So why that spot?
Yes,
specifically.
So that's a really interesting question. When we think parks, we think lush canopies and grass and places to sit and places to relax. Russo Park is this sort of sad stepsister of Worcester Square Park, which is everybody knows and is beautiful and it's the thing. It's the historic park. There's has gorgeous walking paths and vintage street lights. And on Farmers Market Day, people from all over the city come and congregate to walk around Worcester Square Park. But they're actually, the Farmers Market is set up in Russo Park in this little, on this little concrete slab between Worcester Square Park and Worcester Street. And it's, as a resident of the area, it is this sort of sad park-esque thing which apart from the farmer's market is largely unused. It's totally abandoned. People usually walk through or pass through on their way to the nicer park or on their way to Pepe's or Sally's, but never stop to linger there. And it's, once again, it's wasteful because it, the farmer's market, if it does anything other than bring much joy to the neighborhood and to the people who attend the market, it, the farmer's market proves that that park could very well be well loved and well used if there are only a reason to be there.
Yeah, we see a lot of vibrancy on Saturdays.
Saturday like mornings, 9 to 1.
Yeah, 4 hours, 5 hours.
Yeah, Saturday mornings, 9 to 1, that place is hopping. That place is like the locus of cute life in New Haven.
And then people go, and occasionally, it was, so right now you see bird watchers over there. I don't know if you've you've seen the family of really beautiful yellow crown night herons.
Yes.
Who have these babies that look sort of like dinosaurs. They're,
they totally look like pterodactyls.
Prehistoric. But other than that, you're right. People sort of pass through. I've even done reporting where I've stood on a corner there and like asked people for interviews. And often people say like, oh, I'll answer a couple questions, but really I'm on my way to, you know, fill in the blank in Worcester Square. Or I'm on my way to go shopping at Elm City Market, or I'm really gonna, you know, I'm looking forward to this clam pizza. And so better make your questions
they're,
quick.
Yeah, yeah, they're on their way elsewhere. The point is that they're going elsewhere.
So that's the park. But then the other part of it is why coffee? And we'll get into the fact that this is not sort of your first rodeo with food and, right, and with cuisine. But so I am of the mind that everyone likes coffee, even though it's not completely like that. Certainly a lot of the population is addicted to coffee.
This is true.
But but specifically, why coffee?
Right. Why
Other than fuel? Closing.
So coffee is something that is a low ticket item. When I say that, I mean like it's not, if unless you're getting, you know, triple shots of this or that and double pumps of this or that and special types of milk, coffee is a readily accessible item to purchase that is cheap enough that it can be for everyone. It also doesn't require a liquor license, and it also is it's the drink of choice for, as opposed, well, the non-alcoholic drink of choice that invites gathering and invites people to sit and chat. People like to go to coffee shops. I mean, this is my presumption, is people like to go to coffee shops and sip their coffee slowly and see what there is to see, talk to whomever is there to chat with. But we don't have any of that sort of infrastructure. So coffee was this easy, no-brainer beverage that fills a number of different, rather checked a number of different boxes for me. It was accessible enough at a price point that is amenable to many people in the neighborhood. It's not alcoholic, so I didn't have to get special permitting, and it was feasible to do that. And it's something you can have in the morning or afternoon.
Yeah. And you have these very sweet, literally and figuratively, they're quite cute, sort of like stroopwafel cookies.
Correct.
Which are very popular right now. I don't know when speculoos butter got popular, but at some point.
I think when people decided that they liked speculoos and decided to call them speculoos as opposed to the Delta Airline cookie.
Right. And they thought, oh, goodness, we can crush them up and mix them with even more oil, like a little bit more oil, and then we can spread them.
Yeah.
Which seems uniquely American, but it's from a European cookie, so
we get that one for free.
Right? Yeah, exactly. But were those in addition because it, you know, it sort of makes sense, especially if you have a bitter cup of coffee.
Yep.
That you're drinking it with that.
Yes. So the workaround from having as opposed to having freshly baked goods, which I probably couldn't have accommodated with, but my very limited budget and the daily demands of having that delivered and then waste, I went the stroopwafel route, or sort of the dry cookie biscotti route that goes really well with coffee.
And they're simple to assemble. So you assemble them.
Yes. And because of my health permit, I'm technically not allowed to make anything.
Right.
I'm not allowed to bake anything in my home kitchen, and I wasn't about to go spend extra time and effort to bake in somebody else's commercial kitchen. So these are store-bought waffle cookies and store-bought cookie spread, and the main assembly point is spreading, sandwiching.
Yeah, which is wonderful. And then there's the, so you mentioned, you know, the big bad word budget.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, of course, a business aspect of this. And I know that you work very closely with the Coffee Peddler.
Yes.
And so, first of all, how did you choose that vendor? Because there are a lot of different sort of outlets for coffee in New Haven and the nearby towns.
Well, a number of reasons. I chose coffee. So at the outset, I live in Worcester Square, and it takes a while. If I were to go seek out Coffee Peddler's coffee, it would have taken, you know, let's say, like a 5 to 10 minute bike ride and a quite lengthy walk. So I actually never really frequented Coffee Peddler before I engaged them for this business. But I had known of it, and I had friends who used to live in Goatville and would take me to Coffee Peddler, and I always found it to be a very warm and inviting and very classy atmosphere, classy establishment that I was just really, I respected it a lot. The other reason is I asked some of my coffee friends, my coffee aficionado friends, what they thought the best coffee was, and it was a resounding resounding agreement that it was Coffee Peddler. And finally, when I finally met the owner of Coffee Peddler, Ryan Taylor, he blew me away with his expertise and his as a small business owner and as somebody who is very new to the business, but has really just sort of made his mark on the specialty coffee world and takes hospitality very seriously and really echoes that sort of emphasis on customer satisfaction really echoes through the whole operation at Coffee Peddler. I was blown away and was really struck with his passion. And so I decided that rather than go to Willoughby's, we all love and know Willoughby's.
Also a local business.
Also a wonderful local business, but not as totally centrally located, local as Coffee Peddler. Coffee Peddler's in East Haven, on East Street. And Ryan Taylor's from East Haven. So it's like super, super homegrown and hyper local. And let's see, coffee. I love coffee and Audubon, but they seem to have this great little world unto themselves. And because I heard so many great things about Coffee Peddler, that I went that route.
And what were those conversations? I guess, first of all, when did those conversations start? Because this cart is relatively new. It's pretty young. It started sort of right as the summer was kicking in, which I think was good timing because you also have iced coffee. But when did those conversations with Ryan start?
Middle of May, I would like to say.
Oh, wow. So
very, very recently. So I spring, and when I have an idea and I think it's a good enough idea, I just sort of spring to action and figure out all the steps that need to be taken in order for this idea to come to fruition. So when I decided, I was walking back from, like the library one day, and I walked past the corner of Olive and Grand, and there's the big empty garage at 170 Olive, and then there's Allegra Printing, and then Lucibella's on the other side, and then the opposite side of the street, there's 135 Olive, which is used to be the old mini mart, but is now closed.
It's been shuttered for and I then, don't know how long.
Oh, many, like so many months. I think at least a year.
Yeah.
And then opposite that corner, so on the fourth corner is the police department.
Right.
And that is such a busy intersection and has sort of this, one of my dreams is to bring more new life back to Grand Avenue between Olive and the highway overpass. But anyways, that corner seems so integral to the life of the rest of the street, or the rest of Grand Street, Grand Avenue. And it's not used in the way that I would have liked it to be used. So I was thinking, God, wouldn't it be great if we had a coffee place? Also, Fuel's was about to close, and Fuel hadn't had seating in many, many months, and I was sort of tired of complaining about all these things and waiting for some sort of savior to come. So I said, I sort of thought to myself, like, what if I did some sort of adult version of a lemonade stand? Mm. You put a table down, you put two coffee carafes on, and you sell coffee, and then you pack it all up at the end of the day. So the idea of a coffee cart came in this like random walk that I had. And then I just started talking to people. I started talking to my friends in the neighborhood who know a lot about coffee and knew that I had been on a mission to bring coffee or retail or some sort of seating, patio seating community gathering spot to the neighborhood for quite some time. I think one of the first text messages I sent was to Carlos Izaguirre at the Office of Economic Development, and was like, "Hey, what do you think? What do you think about a pop-up coffee stand in Worcester Square to try to revitalize business on Grand Avenue?" He was extremely, extremely receptive to the idea and like sprang to action, put me in touch with Eleanor Slomba at Project Storefronts. And I think the week after, or this was a Friday, afternoon. So I was not expecting to get as much of a response as I did. So I was pleasantly surprised that the very next week, I think Eleanor, Carlos, and I had a meeting.
Oh, great.
And we were like, okay, let's do it.
Wow.
This sounds great. So how do we do it? What needs to be done?
And then, you know, did you go to Ryan and say, hey, yeah. I think this is what my pattern of supply and demand is going to look like. Can you do that?
So my first interaction with Ryan Taylor was actually even more brash and blustery than that. I walked into Coffee Peddler and I'd been to Coffee Peddler maybe like 2 years prior. And I biked over one day and got a croissant. So I was like, okay, am I going to ask? Okay. Finished my croissant, walked back into the Coffee Peddler and was like, all right, two things. I was like, first of all, are you the owner? Ryan goes, yes. And I say, all right, two things. First of all, that was a really great croissant. Second of all, I want to do a pop-up coffee cart and I want you to provide the coffee. What do you think? He was like, okay. And without even really thinking about the details, he says, yes, let's say yes, we'll do it. We'll figure out all the details later. Like,
wow.
when I'm really busy at the shop today, let's find a time to talk through and tell me more about your idea. But let's just say that we're going to do it.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't think I could have
asked
for a better reception.
And then after that, did you meet and did he give you a price point or?
So we had that day I was leaving to fly back to California. For the past like 9 months or so, I've been bi-coastal and I work in California, but I telecommute for most of the month. And then once a month I have to go back for a week or 2 weeks. And so that day I was about to leave for my final business trip. And so we had a brief meeting and talked through the details, talked through who I was, who he was, what my idea was. And we left it as like a 85% likelihood that we were going to do this. And then as soon as I got back from California, we sat down and wrote out a contract. We talked out how many carafes of coffee would likely be needed per day, what the operational mechanics of pickup, drop off, buying the carafes, sourcing the rest of the cafe accoutrements, so straws, sugar, whatever
the
else
works.
We need, the works, and I was very very insistent on making it all very official, so we wrote it out in a very real contract, signed it, dated it, and then we had to sit on it for a while until I got all of my other approvals from the city.
And okay, so now I want to back up a little bit, okay. And then we'll go back to the coffee cart just because, cool. You know, I like not going in a straight line. That's too boring. I think I first became familiar with your name maybe two and a half years ago when mm-hmm. you did a brunch pop-up.
I did.
The late, great Inspired Turkey, which is now a bridal salon that, I don't know, every time I walk past it, it looks like something else has been bedazzled yeah. in the window. But that's okay. I wish them the best of luck because it's much better than an empty storefront.
Yes.
But have you always sort of had a knack for business or an interest in business? Or did that happen when you were a student?
So my path to this sort of brute entrepreneurship, I guess, has taken many turns. Let's just say that I was Yale 2014 and was an English major and had no interest in business whatsoever. I was all about the poetry. All I did was reread and reread poems by Whitman and Wallace Stevens and analyze poems and feel.
Are you like one of the Harold Bloom sycophants?
I am.
Okay,
I
great.
Am. So I was
just
in, I was
as long
in
as
his
we
seminar.
Can get that out of the way.
Yeah. I was in his seminar for many of my during many semesters and had a lot of my education. But I was also towards the end of Yale, I branched out of the Harold Bloom bubble and branched to David Bromwich and Leslie Brisman. Mm. I was very much on the road to applying to graduate school for PhD programs in English. I went to Spain after graduating on a Yale fellowship, and just sort of had my perspective turned around. And I think the immediacy of wanting to apply to graduate school was palliated a bit. And so I think I put that on the back burner for a while, and then really pursued urbanism and real estate development and the sort of grassroots business development through real estate development as a complement to land use policy. And then it was just sort of spiraled out of hand. Then I was like, this is what I have to do. Graduate school will wait.
Well, and Yale, I mean, Yale is a funny thing, or Yale's relationship with New Haven is mm-hmm. a funny thing. So,
so true.
When you, I guess, where were you coming from when you came to Yale? Were you...
Where was I coming from? Where did I...
Like, were you born on the East Coast?
Oh,
were you
no, from the East no. Co- no. So I was born in San Diego, California. Was born and raised in La Jolla, California. So tiny beachside.
So like way the hell on the other side of the country.
On the other side of the world, like basically on the border with Mexico and this like millionaire's retiree village. And decided at 18 when I was applying to college that, I guess I was 17 at the time, that I wanted nothing to do with the West Coast anymore. Applied to no schools west of the Mississippi River. And was like, I'm heading east, people. Despite the fact that I had to go take a job in California this past year, I've for the last, how old am I? Six, 7 years, have been much more East Coast minded. But so when I say that my interest in business has been sort of circuitous, I would probably like to say that my very first enterprise is actually very similar to the one I'm doing now. It was a coffee cart, a beverage table at my local farmer's market in La Jolla, California.
Oh, wow.
And I was 8 years old, and it was called Catherine's Beverage Lounge, and I sold coffee, tea.
Were you drinking coffee at 8 years old?
I was not drinking it, but
okay,
like,
I was going to say, you were probably a very intrepid child without the caffeine.
Yes. Well, I mean, caffeine aside, I was a very intrepid child. I was extremely precocious. I like found ways of mounting strange enterprises, but that was my very first pop-up stand of sorts. And so, and that was when I was 8 years old. When I was in high school, I was not interested in business. I had started my school's mock trial team, so I was like, I like the law. And then I came to Yale and I was like, no, I'm gonna do poetry.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna read and write and think about things.
Which is lovely. I really quickly just want to remind listeners that if you're just joining us, this is WNHH Community Radio, 103.5 FM New Haven, streaming live at www.newhavenindependent.org and broadcasting live from our offices on Elm Street. This is Kitchen Sink. I'm Lucy Gelman. And if you are just entering the conversation, I'm here in the studio with Catherine McCormick, and we are talking about her newest enterprise, which is a coffee cart with coffee, hot and iced, and iced black tea,
sometimes iced peppermint tea.
Ooh, lovely. Mm. from the coffee peddler. But we're sort of backpedaling into the past to begin. And so I mean, I think it's really funny though that you brought up Whitman. This is a huge tangent, but that's okay.
I love tangents.
But that you brought up Whitman, because he sort of also said, like, F it, I'm gonna do it my own way.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone would call Whitman like a great American businessman.
No.
And I don't think Whitman would want to be called a great American businessman. But he definitely had that spirit of freedom, of self-invention,
mm-hmm.
and you know, of sort of rewriting the rules because he didn't like the rules the way they were. And do you feel like you're channeling that at all in your work?
That's very sweet. I'd like to think so. I've actually never thought about it in terms of channeling his what I like to call this. There's a section of Song Myself in which that goes something like, urge and urge the procreant energy of the world, always upwards and onwards, this sort of forward moving energy and belief in progressivism. But I do think that there's this sort of scrappy, raw energy that I am channeling, and I think that's you're right to point out that it's a very Whitmanian, and very Whitmanian American, energy, which I am flattered that is would be associated with my name, but yeah.
Well, and sort of in that spirit. So there's also Dickinson. Mm-hmm. I know that Harold Bloom's Professor Bloom's latest book is sort of Whitman, Dickinson, and Melville.
I haven't actually read his latest book.
That's okay. That's okay.
He has written so many books, and my first course with Bloom was Emerson, Whitman, Dickinson, Melville, Stevens, and Hart Crane. So I think I got the Harold Bloom take on. And this sort of these things repeat,
but Dickinson, you know, within sort of the confines of what she could and couldn't do for a woman at the time, she also sort of said like, "Well, screw it,
yeah, I'm doing it my way.
I'm going to do it my way." And so I want to talk about being a female entrepreneur,
yes,
because I think that's part of it. And I don't want to say it's all of it, but even in New Haven, which is this great little blue bubble. Especially right now,
mm-hmm.
Sexism is real. It's alive.
Yes.
I've dealt with it as a female reporter. And so is it something that you come up against? Was it something you worried about with this or with your first venture at Inspired Turkey, your first venture in New Haven,
mm-hmm.
which was brunch at Inspired Turkey?
Yes. So I'll answer that in two parts. I think as a female entrepreneur, I have taken it for granted that we do live in this wonderful blue bubble, and I never premeditate on the idea that sexism might be an issue. It has presented itself as an issue, not in terms of my pop-up ventures, mm-hmm. but in other sort of real estate dealings. I think one of the reasons I think that I've been lucky and haven't had to be deterred by sexism in as far as my pop-up ventures go, is that I pretend like it doesn't exist until it exists.
Hmm.
I say that like there's no, I know where I stand. I wrote my thesis on Coriolanus, and there's this line where he says, "I play the man. I say that I play the man I am." And so I really say that I play the woman I am. And I sort of tell myself these things don't exist until they exist and apply to me. And when they do come up as hurdles, finding the most graceful way to squash them.
So you had this moment. I'm also interested in this moment of discovery that you had sort of while you were in Spain and then mm-hmm. when you came back, because I don't know a lot about Spain and Spanish culture, but I know that a lot of Europe is very sexist.
Yeah,
in fact,
Spain, like probably one of the worst.
Yeah. I know France.
No offense,
France
Spaniards.
Is a big offender. So I would assume that it's close. You know, as its close neighbor, Spain is maybe also a little bit egregious.
Probably much worse. The culture of machismo is much bigger in Hispanic culture, for who knows what reason. But there is I also lived in Argentina, and in Uruguay at one point, and like machismo is sort of and I would like lived very close to the Mexican border, so like machismo and the sort of chauvinism as part of these cultures is very much a well practiced and well accepted fact. And none of this has, none of it is okay, but it's one of those things that is it's so regular that women in these cultures are like, that's just a very machista thing to say. Or that's just like a very machista mindset. And they sort of pass it off as like, yeah, it's whatever.
But how did it change your outlook? I guess I'm also interested in the work that you were doing mm-hmm. while you were abroad. So let's start with that.
Whew, that's a long story.
That's okay. We like long stories here at WNET.
It was, I got a fellowship from Yale to set up an education exchange between the Reina Sofia Museum, which is the big, fancy contemporary art museum in Madrid, and a small community organization blocks away from the museum. And the idea behind it was that the Reina Sofia Museum had some extraordinary museum education programs, just like some of the most creative types of programming for school children, and that the only people who could access those were schools that had booked, you know, 9 months in advance,
mm-hmm.
and it was the so that's one aspect of it. And I was interested in education, interested in arts education at the time. And then the other part of it is that the Reina Sofia Museum is uniquely situated in what is a neighborhood of old Madrid or central Madrid called Lavapiés, which is known to be the sort of immigrant hub, the sort of central urban immigrant hub of Madrid, where people from new immigrants from North Africa or from Senegal or Nigeria or Pakistan, the Indian subcontinent, like first move, it's the de facto like old Lower East Side of New York, but in Madrid. And in addition to that, it's sort of where a lot of artists, Spanish artists, congregate in Madrid because of the sort of fluidity with culture and openness to new ideas. It's also the seat of the new political party Podemos. So like it's sort of leftist, bohemian, and also new immigrants. So the spectrum is there, and there was just a lot of synergies that I could feasibly coordinate.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that this world-class museum with these super awesome education programs was like two blocks away, or like within this neighborhood and two blocks away from a community organization of basically squatters. So this was sort of my nascent interest in urbanism. It was an old plot of land in the middle of two buildings, sort of like an empty abandoned lot that the neighbors had squatted on, moved into, and transformed into a community garden, an outdoor, this thing was amazing. It was a community garden. It was an outdoor theater, and there was a teaching classroom, and they had events there every Sunday. And it was just like the coolest place where anybody, any of the neighbors were welcome to come to and do whatever they wanted to do, or just hang out, have no real direction whatsoever. And they didn't have, despite having this fantastic classroom, amphitheater of sorts, and education materials, they didn't have any education programming. Mm. And because it was situated in the middle of this neighborhood where there are a number of new children of new immigrants, children who are live in Spain, were born in Spain, presumably, and like are Spanish, but don't necessarily have access to the very traditional Spanish cultural institutions, I thought it would be an interesting project to try to export the programming from the Reina Sofia Museum, which is sort of touted as this beacon of modernity for Spanish people, sort of like this was there in the 80s when it was like built and made into a museum. This was like, this is our way forward, but we're still traditionally Spanish, but this is our new way forward. And it was it's quintessentially modern Spain thing. So exporting those programming and that ethos out into the community to try to spread the sort of new Spain, new modern Spain, and welcoming interaction with the arts and with Spanish culture. Most of the artists that are featured in the Reina Sofia are of Spanish origin. So having them have this sort of coordinating it in exchange between the museum, its education programs, this cultural center, the members, or rather the neighbors who are invited openly to engage with this cultural center, and seeing what kind of exchange could happen, what kind of interactions and what kind of like horizontal educational possibilities could be spurred.
And I'm reminded of a colleague, she's actually moving on to Tougaloo College in Mississippi, but a colleague of mine, LaTanya Autry, who does a very similar program here. So cool. She was at the Yale University Art Gallery for a long time and teaches a course called The Art of Black Descent with really cool imagery, really cool programming. And when the Yale Art Gallery wasn't opening itself to the people LaTanya wanted to be teaching to, she said, screw it, I'm going to go into the community.
Yeah.
So and went around to public schools, and hopefully that still continues. But when you say urbanism, because this is something I've talked to her about too, urbanism is such a big word.
Yes.
Like its borders just go on and on and on, and they're very permeable.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes eminent domain. It includes land use questions.
Yes.
It includes fair housing,
yes,
subsidized housing. And then also like urban architecture, landscaping, urban planning.
Mm-hmm.
So for you, is there some, meeting point in that? Or of your interest? I know
sure.
you said also real estate, but real estate can cover
so many different
things.
So my understanding and the point at which I center on is the placement of buildings and the synergies that happen between people inside the buildings, people on the street. Really it's if you have a landed building or a landed place, what sorts of human interactions revolve around that place? I think that's the other, like the most stripped down and simplified way of describing my interest in urbanism is like place and people.
And in that way, so you've also made this choice to stay in New Haven,
yes,
which is very interesting to me. But New Haven has
I've like clawed my way back to be in New Haven numerous times.
New Haven has a fair amount of mixed use housing, which is the first thing that my mind jumps to when you talk about this. So, is that maybe one of the reasons or what are the reasons that New Haven has sort of brought you back? I just got back from this vacation and was mm-hmm. reminded how large the country was.
Yes.
It's immense.
It's immense.
Which you tend to forget when you're in this very tight-knit town mm-hmm. of 132,000 people. So what was it about New Haven?
So it has everything to do with the people and the way that I feel in this neighborhood. Or rather, I actually think of New Haven as like my extended large neighborhood.
Mm.
I live in this pocket neighborhood of Worcester Square, but the entirety of the city, which is quite small, but it is complex enough that it gets to be called a city. I think that it's the interplay between people and space and conversations that are had in place in certain places and not had in other places, where people live, where people work, where people walk. It's all very visible and observable in this small city. And it has very little. It has everything to do with the people that the people and personalities I've been able to meet in this wonderful city. Let's see. I think I've gravitated back to New Haven so many times because I feel as though I've sort of developed a family here.
Hmm.
In a weird sense, I do not have kids. And
that's really beautiful.
Yeah. Carol and Robert Orr, so I met Carol Orr because I walked into her store when I was a junior in college and was like, hey, I'm in your store a lot.
Which is EBM Vintage. Formerly
English Building Market.
Yes, that
formerly
one.
English Building Market, but EBM Vintage. I walked into her store one day and was like, hey, I'm in here a lot. And like, basically I just need a little respite from Yale's campus and want to look at pretty things. So can I work here? She said, yes. She like, no other questions asked. I think maybe the reason I love New Haven so much is because I can walk into these establishments and like with all sorts of arrogance and bluster, just be like, hey, you, can I be part of you?
Right. Yeah.
And to my great satisfaction, a few people have said yes over the years.
And are you a fairly mobile person? And by that I mean, so you have this mobile cart, and
mm-hmm.
so I know, yes, you can move around if you either ever get tired of being at Russo Park, or if you pass a space perhaps and you say, oh, this is actually an area of great need, and then go back to the Parks Department, Economic Development in the city and say like, hey, I've identified the space of great need. But as a person and as someone who was at Yale, because Yale has a very particular relationship.
Yes. And most of the students are transient. They're here for two
right.
or 3 years and then they leave.
Well, and having worked, so when I moved here, I worked for the Yale Art Gallery and having worked with some undergraduates, I know that Yale draws a pretty tight radius around campus, or Yale suggests
mm-hmm.
that there perhaps is a very tight perimeter kind of in which you are safe, and then if you go beyond that, all bets are off. When in fact, the community is a fairly safe one,
yes.
especially if you know people,
yeah.
and you know folks in neighborhoods where you're walking and you think, oh, these are neighborhoods. This is where people live.
Exactly.
I found that, you know, by no means only Yale, but sort of when you get into the eds and meds mentality, mm-hmm. you can kind of dehumanize neighborhoods. And so Absolutely. For you, do you walk around a lot? Do you Yes. find yourself in different neighborhoods a lot?
I do. So I did not have a car until like 2 months ago. I walked and biked around New Haven, exclusively walked and biked around New Haven, and would wander and explore. That was one of the reasons why I discovered EBM vintage in the first place, because I went on a walk one day and was like, I need to get away from my residential college and go see what there is to see. I also bought my first bike at Devil's Gear and was like, great, now I can toot around town even further. I've often like bike around and walk around Fairhaven, and I'm like, there are these great stores and like hidden gems here and there.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So it's always like a really fun excursion to go see other things. And I am very mobile and like go to different neighborhoods. And I think what I like to see in neighborhoods is, going back to, I suppose, my interest in like buildings and land, is how people occupy their space. Especially in neighborhoods which have character, have different characters, going to see and observe how people occupy their homes, how people occupy the streets in front of their homes, the public domain in front of their homes, or what other sorts of public or community or public-private spaces are available for people to congregate outside of the total privacy of their own homes, but still within the intimacy and the comforts of the known world of like the known neighborhood transactions.
And it sounds so much like you enjoy being outside. So your business, The Coffee Cart, is mm-hmm. called Downtown Table.
Yes.
And so of course, when you insert table in any sentence, it has this great connotation of people gathering around
exactly.
a physical space
yes.
and sharing conversation, maybe meeting each other. Do you ever see not being outside? And I don't mean, you know, in the winter if there are 4 or 5 feet of snow, but do you ever see sort of being in a brick and mortar place, or do you think the pop-up model is for you?
That is a really good question. I think that pop-ups are really, really valuable tools. And I imagine that my next venture will if it's not some sort of business development that lends itself to food consumption or a placemaking of a dining sense, then it will be some pop-up of a different kind. Brick and mortars are absolutely essential, and I'm a big proponent of brick and mortars. I haven't quite made it to finished an idea to a brick and mortar fruition.
And they're expensive. The cost
they
of
are
overhead
expensive.
Are enormous.
Extremely expensive, but absolutely necessary. If I had more time to work on this project, the impending start of law school is kind of like hanging over my head. I'm going to have to stop thinking about this at some point, or I'm going to have a brilliant idea between now and August 14th and make moves as to how to put this into a brick and mortar. Because brick and mortars are the neighborhood stabilization tools, and those are what make neighborhoods work. How these sorts of interchanges of ideas become more expected and more expected and sustainable in many ways. Because this pop-up thing is wonderful, and it's fun and it's different, and it's out in the open, quite literally. It's outside, so it's visible. But it's, if anything, this is a data gathering mission to try to make the argument to somebody or to myself, if I can have a brilliant idea between now and then, to make the argument that the neighborhood can support and wants some sort of community gathering spot, whether it's a cafe/restaurant/bar, whatever it may be. The data that I'm gathering is hopefully without necessarily doing away with this pop-up model or doing away with the Russo Park patio, at least trying to make the argument that a brick and mortar somewhere right around where I am needs to be.
And before we go, I do want to talk about this next chapter and sort of how it Oh, it fits into everything, overwhelming as it may be. So if you're just joining us, this is The Kitchen Sink on WNHHLP 103.5 FM New Haven. I'm your host, Lucy Gelman, and I'm here with small business owner slash fledgling legal expert slash urbanism, ingenue slash whatever else, Catherine McCormick. And we're chatting about her coffee cart and her interest in urbanism and sort of what that means for her. But Catherine, you know, you mentioned the impending start of law school.
Yes.
And so I want to talk about that, especially because I feel like law and the legal profession is at a very interesting point right now.
Yes.
Where the American Bar Association is even saying to people, don't do it. Like, don't do it. Turn around. Look back right now. Like, you don't have to do this. And so why were you motivated to go to law school?
Yes. So maybe this circles back in a number of different ways. But my interest in urbanism in pop-up retail and neighborhood stabilization in many ways comes back to real estate transactions. And I've been doing real estate transactions in Napa, California for the past year and a half or so, year and change. And it's an interesting work environment. It's like very much in line with what I want to be doing as far as developing and redeveloping and, you know, saving neighborhoods from being either torn apart or built in an unwise fashion that is insensitive to current residents. Use any sort of moniker you want as a substitute for that explanation. But
redlining.
Yeah. Gentrification. I mean, like, it comes in so many different ways, but it really is my interest in people and the places that they live and the places they occupy. This all goes back to, like, if you are displaced or you are forced to move or you're forced to feel alien or outside of you, what is supposed to be comforting, that's got to be like the worst feeling in the world. And I've felt it in a number of different ways, and never so much as had been like actually displaced from my home, but, you know, varying shades of gray. Why law? So I've been doing these real estate transactions and have been I've been developing real estate, and there is so much legal minutia that happens within real estate, creating lease documents or signing contracts with developers. My main interest is public-private partnerships. So if a government agency is selling a piece of land or is going to give a developer a long-term lease to develop something with the hopes that this new building is going to generate not only private money and private revenues, but also add to public revenues. It is in everybody's best interest, so to speak, that this project come to fruition. But the types of hurdles that are placed when public agencies get involved, or it's when it's their land that they're ceding or selling, there's so much. There are a lot of legal questions and policy questions that come up. Not to mention the fact that real estate transactions require a good bit of knowledge regarding contracts and well-written contracts. I'm really into contracts for some reason. I think law school also enables me to add credential to my name to say that if I'm going to advocate for this and that, this or that policy, that I'm actually speaking from a place of professionalism, and I am to be taken as such.
And you're not going far.
Not going far. I'm going to Quinnipiac.
Yeah, which is wonderful. But do you see, so we've talked about how special New Haven is, but you know, as we wind down, do you see staying here? Do you see going back to the East Coast, or sorry, to the other coast, the West Coast, the lesser coast?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure it's really hard to be away from, you know, what you knew growing up.
Yeah, no, actually not at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, definitely never moving back west. And I almost feel as though when I moved out to New Haven from California at 18, like, I just started over. I started and I just began to see the world all over again and learn the world all over again. So when I go back to California, I'm like in a foreign country. I don't know anything about that life. I sort of relate to it from these, from nostalgic memories, if I have nostalgic memories at all, just memories of childhood in which I remember sitting in traffic on highways or like never being able to walk anywhere. And it's completely foreign to me and something that I do not want to touch with a 10-foot pole.
Do you visit though? I mean, right now you commute back for work. Do you visit?
I do not ever visit my hometown. So as soon as I graduated from high school, like I think the day that I moved out to New Haven, my family moved out of its house, of our house in San Diego, and like closed up shop.
Oh, wow.
There. No more San Diego, no more La Jolla. So going back is really a chore. I do have friends that I'd care about there, but it's really hard to see them. And most of them either are in San Francisco or some of them are actually in New York. And so going back to my hometown has no real benefit for me.
Right.
And San Diego's problems are not the problems that I want to solve. Mm. The problems that I want to solve are very much brownfield, old industrial sites, rust belt revitalization.
Oh, so maybe a little Midwest time.
Maybe a little Midwest. Yeah. I wouldn't be opposed to that. But I do see, at least for the near future, that New Haven is a place for me. I've made really wonderful connections, not only with people that I've met through this or that business dealing, but also I think that I've connected really well with people in city government. I went in 2 weeks ago to talk to Tom Talbot at City Plan, and I thought we had a great meeting. He was like, he gave me some like sort of avuncular advice, and I was like, this is nice. You're a friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people within, so Project Storefronts, Eleanor just seems to be, they're all solid people and they're excited about the things that I'm excited about. So it seems as though for the time being, the city of New Haven and I are going to be friends. We're going
to
be friends.
Well, and Tom Talbot's a good person to know with his zoning Bible.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So just as we wind down, Catherine McCormick, tell me and tell listeners how they can find you if they think, okay, what I really need after this interview is a strong cup of coffee.
Yes, I am at the corner of Chapel and De Palma Court. If you're going down Chapel, I will be on the right-hand side across from Worcester Square Park. And I'm unfortunately not out there right now because, one, I'm in this interview, and two, it is raining outside. So heads up, if it's raining or if it like will threaten to rain, I may not come out.
Yeah.
But you may follow me on Instagram at Downtown Table, all one word, and I will usually post my schedule.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. This
is
fun.
And I hope you have a wonderful and adequately caffeinated day.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks.